Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. Tom, your mighty series about Lord Byron has just concluded, hasn't it? You happy with it?
Very happy. Yeah, I felt we marked the anniversary of his death appropriately.
Well, that was your dream, wasn't it, Byron? I mean, that's basically your pet subject. I mean, that was your original subject, first thing you ever wrote about.
I mean, I did say, I think it was, I mean, maybe 3 years ago, I said we got to do Byron to mark the anniversary of his death.
Yeah. At the time, there was kind of a silence and weak smiles from the assembled company.
Well, I mean, I certainly didn't think 3 years ago that we'd end up doing four episodes on him.
Can I ask you a question? A personal question.
Yeah.
You were going to do graduate work on Lord Byron, weren't you? Is that right?
On Byron and his relationship to Greek literature and history.
And how far did you get with it?
Not very far, because I decided pretty quickly that Byron was an inappropriate subject for academic ease.
Yeah.
That what made him interesting was almost impossible to express in an academic way.
Yeah.
Obviously, there is an academic framework that exists for explaining the significance of a figure.
Yes.
And that's true in the field of literature as it is of history. But Byron is on the kind of intersection point between literary and historical significance.
Mm.
And what makes him significant is quite hard to express academically.
You can't theorize it.
So it's a bit like trying to explain music or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to experience it, really. I thought I would better articulate what made Byron significant and interesting by writing a novel in which he was a vampire. That was my self-justification.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. And I genuinely think that.
And also surely make more money.
Yeah. And also I just realized I'd made a terrible mistake. I didn't want to be an academic. All my friends had left university and gone off.
Yeah. Of course.
I just thought, no, I don't want to do this at all.
Yeah. I know that very well. I mean, when I was doing my PhD and I had friends who were working in newspapers or kind of working for investment banks or something, and you kind of think, oh my God, I'm still a student. Something's gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Yeah. And the other thing, I suppose, your study of Byron sounds more like cultural history to me than literary.
No, it was very much about literature as well. I mean, we didn't really discuss Byron's significance as a poet. I mean, I just kind of said he's a great poet.
Yeah.
And people had to take it on trust. But he is, I mean, by any measure, Don Juan, I think, is probably the greatest comic poem in English.
Mm-hmm.
And the comedy depends on the fact that it is Byron writing it. So it's this romantic figure, you know, who's cloaked in scandal and romance, the hint of the vampiric, writing a great comic novel. It's as though Nietzsche had written Bertie Wooster.
That's an extraordinary image.
Yeah, that gives you a sense of the tension that exists and why he's so difficult to write about in the literary context. Because the greatness of the poem, I think even if you didn't know who Byron was, the greatness of Don Juan would be evident. It's very, very funny. The control of meter, of rhyme is, I mean, just extraordinary. The things that he can do with rhyme, he can make brilliant jokes and then he can make as moving as you could want. And he controls it with this kind of absolute effortless sense of pace and contrast. But the fact that it's Byron doing it obviously adds an entire new frisson.
Yeah. So we'll come back to one of the issues raised by the Byron series, not Byron himself specifically, because I imagine some people have had enough of Byron. But we'll come back to one of the issues in a second. But just to give people a heads up, so this week, Tom, a member should have it in their feeds. We had the first Emperor of China.
Yes, that came out on Monday. And then tomorrow,
the long-awaited episode on the Habsburgs. So this is kind of a fun episode, isn't it? We're not trying to give a deeply meditated geopolitical analysis of the Habsburg dynasty and its sort of territorial domains, because what we actually did was we invited a Habsburg onto the show to explain why he thinks his family's history is so interesting and the secrets of their success. That's right, isn't it?
But more than that, why everyone should live like a Habsburg.
He does make that case, doesn't he?
The Habsburg as moral exemplars.
Was there a point in that conversation where he said that I was probably going to hell? Have I imagined that? I vaguely remember something along those lines.
Well, it was time that somebody said it, Dominic.
Yeah. So there's the Habsburgs. People wondered whether it really existed because it's been hanging around for almost a year. But it definitely exists and it'll be out this week.
It's great fun. It's great.
And then next week, also great fun, it's one of our real blockbusters. It is the story of George Custer, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Battle of the Little Bighorn, The Massacre at Wounded Knee, and so on and so forth. And this is going to be great fun, isn't it?
It's a tremendous story.
Yeah, it's an amazing story.
And it's one that we're both fascinated by.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So really good fun. Now, there's this big issue hanging over the Byron series, not about Byron specifically, but Henry Trotter sent us an email. And by the way, if you want to submit questions to future bonus episodes, you can do it by email or on Twitter, as well as on their Discord chat community. So don't feel limited to the Discord. So Henry Trotter's email was all about homosexuality. He's comparing the treatment of Byron to that of Oscar Wilde 80 years later, and even Jeremy Thorpe 80 years after that. So two other people who featured in our podcasts. To what extent has there always been a tacit acceptance of even support for homosexuality within the British establishment? So he says, by and large, Victorian prosecutions for homosexual acts were mostly limited to sexual assaults on young boys, and that often leniency was applied to what are more easily understood as consensual relationships. So what was the moral context in which Byron and then later Wilde were being judged? Was there a sort of sense of live and let live, especially at the top? So Henry Trotter says, was homosexuality considered a vice that was implicitly accepted among the privileged classes, but morally beyond the pale in the general population? So in other words, if you're a respectable person, could you get away with it? Whereas lower down the social scale, a different matter. And was England or Britain different from France, Europe, or the Ottoman Empire, as Byron clearly thought it was or wanted it to be? So there's lots to unpack there, Tom. Do you want to have a go at some of that? Do you have views?
No, I don't think there was any tolerance of it. And I think that Britain was unusually hostile. What I think was winked at was fumblings that might go on in boarding school.
Right.
Would you agree with that? I mean, it was never approved of,
mm-hmm.
but it was accepted that perhaps this was something that might happen. But I think that aristocrats, just as much as anyone else, were liable to persecution.
Yeah.
And the classic example of this is someone who Byron was very interested in, unsurprisingly, which is William Beckford, who was the great heir of a massive sugar fortune. So that marks him down immediately. And he constructed this enormous folly at Fonthill, not far from Salisbury, actually. I play cricket there.
Right.
In fact, I play cricket there on Saturday. And he was condemned for sodomy and went into exile in Portugal and was clearly driven out and left because, I suppose, a bit like Polanski, there's a kind of slight hint of Polanski about him.
All right, yeah.
There's kind of definite underage element to it. And he was a man of great literary talent. So he wrote an orientalist kind of gothic-y novel called Vartek.
Mm.
So you can see why Byron was interested in him. And actually, Beckford is name-checked in Childe Harold. And I think there's no question that Byron worried that this would happen to him. So the book really that kind of highlighted all this, it came out in, I think, the 70s or the 80s, and it was by a guy called Lewis Crompton. And he wrote a book, Byron and Greek Love, Homophobia in 19th Century England. And it's partly about Byron. But more than that, it's about how anxieties about homosexuality, which had always been there, I mean, right the way through the 18th century. So what is it? The Molly houses.
Yeah.
They were always being raided and closed down.
Mm.
But it becomes kind of fused with an anxiety about the French Revolution, a sense that the standards of religion and patriotic behavior are constantly under threat. And so the fact that Byron is a Whig, that he is associated with Holland House, which is a kind of seen as a hotbed of Francophile antipatriotism, I mean, it doesn't make it any easier for him. And I think that Britain is absolutely exceptional and is seen as being exceptional from abroad. So Byron calls it a tight little island.
Hmm. That's more censorious than other.
Yeah. It's seen as being more censorious. It's more uptight. It's more hostile to any hint of sexual experimentation, which of course then feeds into the eroticization of the figure, particularly of the English aristocrat on the continent.
Yeah.
Because it's assumed that behind the chill facade, all kinds of unspeakable things are being practiced, which again, I think explains the potency of Byron's reputation on the continent.
So just to wind it out from Byron, I think it's a really, really complicated picture, and any generalization is very dangerous. But I agree that there's always a huge element of danger. And the complexity is that there obviously are people who do have gay relationships and they sort of can somehow get away with it in plain sight. I mean, the example actually that we've talked about, so this is from a later period, 20th century. The example that we've referred to before is Stanley Baldwin's son, Oliver Baldwin. He lives with a guy called Johnny. Stanley Baldwin has him for Sunday lunch and stuff. The two guys live together. You know, there are some raised eyebrows, but everybody in the world of Westminster politics, high society or whatever, knows this is going on. I mean, the same thing is true of somebody like Chips Channon, if you read his diaries. Everybody knows. But no matter how privileged you are, you can never escape the fear. You live with the fear. And the good example of that, Tom, is a guy called Lord Montague of Bewley.
Yeah.
You know, aristocrat, was in the Grenadier Guards. He went to Eton. He went to Oxford. He was, you know, absolutely part of the very, very upper crust. But he was tried and imprisoned for 12 months in 1954 for consensual homosexual offences. So this was as part of a much wider sort of scare in 1950s Britain.
Which also picked up John Gielgud, didn't it? Great actor.
Exactly. John Gielgud was arrested in a public toilet. And as with the Byron thing, Tom, the scare in the 1950s, homosexuality was seen as unpatriotic, as sinister and subversive, and it was linked to communist espionage.
Yeah.
So there's always been an association.
An ideological element to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's in the context of wars, isn't it, particularly? And I suppose inevitably, because wars require men to be in very close contact with one another.
Yeah.
And if you assume that homosexuality equates to effeminacy, which I think was quite strongly held, mm-hmm. both in the Napoleonic period and in the Second World War,
yeah,
there's going to be anxiety about that. So the strictures against, and people talk about rum, sodomy and the lash,
yeah,
in the Royal Navy, but actually the strictures against any hint of it were brutal. I mean, incredibly brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, against that, there's the question of female same-sex relations. And one of the most famous examples of those, they were visited by Byron, visited by Shelley, actually visited by the Duke of Wellington, amazingly, and that's the ladies of Llangollen, mm-hmm. who were two Irish women who lived together as a couple. And, you know, they were a cause of scandal, definitely, which is why people were so interested in going to see them. But they were also, people were fascinated by them.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any sense that, you know, they were in danger of their lives. It was male homosexuality that caused anxieties, not female homosexuality, which was kind of seen as something odd, but not something as threatening.
Well, if you think about even detective fiction or something, the figures of a sort of female couple, you know, ladies of a certain age who go to the continent together and live together and are effectively, you know, partners, they're very common, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that idea that women will form relationships that will be lifelong, is very common in sort of late 19th, early 20th century fiction. I mean, you see it again and again, and that reflected genuine social patterns.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the most psychologically acute portrayals of a relationship in Dickens, who is not normally thought of as, you know, a laureate of homosexual relationships, is in Little Dorrit between Tattycoram,
oh, yeah.
who is a foundling who's been brought in to serve as a maid for an upper-class girl and is deeply, deeply resentful of her kind of, she sees it, her servile status. And this clearly dominant lesbian woman called Miss Wade.
That's right, yeah.
And they have a very, very subtly, sophisticatedly drawn relationship in a way that you just wouldn't get a kind of a male equivalent in a Dickens novel, I think.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, of course, what we don't know so much about is the story of sort of gay relationships further down the social spectrum. And you just don't know how out of the public eye, as it were.
It must be.
So for people who are interested in this, actually, Tom, at the end of May, Penguin are publishing an absolutely extraordinary book. It's called Some Men in London, Volume 1, Queer Life, 1945 to 1959. So it's basically a huge collage and anthology of diaries, letters, memoirs, newspaper reports, trial documents, all of this, about actually what life was like for homosexual men in London in the 1940s and 1950s. And then there's another volume, which is on the 1960s. It's been compiled by this guy, Peter Parker, who wrote a brilliant book about Houseman, if you read that, Houseman Country. I've seen the advanced copies, and it's amazing because the sort of collage effect gives you a sense of the extreme complexity of this picture. So there are gay pubs, you know, this in an age when homosexuality is illegal, there are recognized gay pubs.
Yeah, there's one on Chatham High Street, Dominic, as we'll be finding out when we go on our tour of...
Right, I look forward to it. So it's sort of, it does happen. And sometimes, you know, people can live their lives, well, get away with it, but the axe is always hanging over you, as it were.
I think in a way, I mean, obviously the 20th century sees it going from being illegal to being almost illegal to think it should be illegal.
Yeah.
I mean, the pace of change over our lifetimes has been incredible.
Yes.
But the 19th century, I think, is an equally profound period of change because it goes from being at the beginning of the 19th century, the assumption that, well, I mean, the emphasis is on sodomy, the idea that it's a sin, that it's something that you choose to do, like rape.
Yeah.
Or theft or murder or whatever.
Yeah.
It's something that is divorced from your nature. And then by the end of the 19th century, the word homosexual has been coined. Heterosexual has also been coined. The idea that it is a mental state is something that German psychologists, and then they're so influential that the British start to pick it up as well. And the idea of a kind of innate nature is something that by the end of the 19th century, inevitably is starting to inform public attitudes to it.
Yeah.
Because of course, what we haven't talked about, and definitely this is something that, as with Wilde, so with Byron, makes the notion of him as a gay hero problematic, is that there's clearly a kind of attraction to what would be defined as underage boys in both cases, I think.
Yeah.
And of course, people who have sex underage are registered as sex offenders.
Yeah.
And that is very much the attitude that, you know, there would have been towards homosexual people in the early 19th century. They were sex offenders. They were people who are criminal. They're people who are offending against public morality. And we still have that. It's just that the boundaries have changed. And Henry Trotter asks about the Ottomans. I mean, I think there are cultural differences that Byron is correct to identify. And that explains the appeal of the classics. You know, I mean, it's kind of mad that, you know, the aristocrats are all being sent off to same-sex boarding schools where they're being taught, you know, texts that treat same-sex relations as being something admirable.
Yeah.
And then they get told, well, we're going to execute you if you follow up on this. I mean, it's, you can understand why it's a bit confusing for a young lad.
Yeah.
And likewise, I think, you know, same-sex relations are not Quranically condoned, to put it mildly.
Mm.
And yet in, you know, the Muslim paradise, there are young boys who will be serving the faithful. So again, there are tensions there as well that people in the Ottoman Empire undoubtedly were exploiting. And I'm fairly confident Byron was exploiting as well.
Okay. So, Henry, we've given a pretty rambling, complicated answer to your excellent question. I guess, but that's the answer, isn't it?
It is complicated. Yeah.
That the context is generally very censorious, but it is very complicated. And it's partly a question of luck, actually, as Lord Montague Bewley found out in 1954, or John Gielgud, or any of these characters. I mean, could Wilde have got away with it if he'd been more discreet, Tom? I think quite possibly he could.
Yeah. I think he'd have got away with it if he hadn't sued Marcus Queensberry for libel.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so let's do some other questions before we wrap up. Tom, a question from Liam Clancy. What is history's most important boat?
That's a very good question. Well, it depends how you measure most important, I suppose. Santa Maria, I guess, would be.
Yeah, I was going to say Columbus's boats. Of course, I'm surprised you haven't chosen Noah's Ark. But maybe you don't believe that really existed. Well,
that didn't exist, did it?
Yeah.
Well, of course, I mean, legendary boats. There's the Argo, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
And we will be talking about that because we're going to be doing a series on Greek heroes. So we'll be looking at Jason, who commanded the Argo and the Argonauts.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Bronze Age ship that sunk off the coast of what's now southern Turkey.
Yeah.
That reveals an enormous amount about the late Bronze Age.
Okay.
Because the sources are relatively so few, the information that that boat provides is enormous and immense and disproportionate. So that might be another one to throw into the mix. So from a historical point of view, perhaps that's an important one.
So another nautical question for you from Jim Sayers. Was the Battle of Trafalgar crucial to the success of the anti-slavery movement?
Yes.
Good. I'm glad you said that.
Because what it did was to establish the supremacy of the Royal Navy pretty much for a century.
Yes, absolutely.
It meant that Britannia did rule the waves. And it meant that when Lord Castlereagh went to the Congress of Vienna in 1814 to negotiate with the continental powers in the wake of what seemed to be Napoleon's overthrow. I mean, it's the first real example that I can think of a figure in an elected government being obliged to go and make a case that he doesn't necessarily believe in simply because there are mass demonstrations happening in the streets of his country. So Lord Castlereagh goes knowing that he has to argue for abolitionism because the scale of abolitionism in Britain has reached the peak where he has no real choice but to do that. And when he goes there, he has to make this case to countries like Portugal, like Spain, like France, who have been profiting from the slave trade. And he can push this case because they all know that they can't possibly compete with the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
And so effectively, what is agreed at the Congress of Vienna is the birth of what today would rank as international law.
Hmm.
The idea that there will be frameworks that govern internationally, whether you're a Protestant power or a Catholic power, those frameworks of law will govern the transport of slaves on the sea. And it provides the international legal framework for the Royal Navy then to impose the abolitionism, you know, that has kind of taken fire over the course of the Napoleonic Wars. So I would say it's absolutely crucial to the abolition of the slave trade.
I agree. I think it's a foundational moment of what you call liberal imperialism, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely.
It creates a liberal imperialist dominion of the seas. So with the Royal Navy opposed to it, the slave trade becomes very difficult. We talked about this in our episode about Brazil, actually, that how in Brazil, which came under immense pressure from the Royal Navy, they have a saying, a law for the English to see.
Yeah.
They had to pass laws under pressure from Britain.
Yeah.
Now, had Britain not had that naval dominance, and of course it matters that it's Britain, not France, that has that naval dominance, because Britain has that often Quaker-driven abolitionist movement.
It's evangelical.
Yeah, evangelical impetus. Now, of course, there are some abolitionists in France, but I don't think the movement has the same kind of evangelical sort of tone or fire or popular support in the way that it does in Britain.
And of course, it's not just European powers that the Royal Navy ends up patrolling. It's also the Muslim powers. And the Muslim powers find it even more incomprehensible that the British are so obsessed by this. But because, you know, they can't really do anything without factoring in the power of the Royal Navy to control the seas, they have to, you know, they have to go along with it.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Should we do one more?
Yeah. So here's one from Athel King. Would you prefer Wolves to win the Premiership, or would you rather be asked to star as Bilbo in a new Lord of the Rings?
I'd prefer Wolves to win the Premier League. Bilbo, that would be a lot of hanging around.
A lot of makeup, wouldn't it?
I don't think it'd be too much makeup.
Well, you'd have your feet.
I suppose there'd be feet. But I think making TV or films, as we both know, Tom, you're just sitting around for long periods, waiting for them to set up the shots. That'd be very boring.
Same with watching Wolves, though, to be fair.
Not at all. I wouldn't be able to do the rest is history. And that would be very disappointing.
Oh, that would be very sad.
I'd be sorry for you more than anybody.
That's kind.
So, no, I think I'd much rather see Wolves win the Premier League. I think being an actor must be very boring.
Yeah, I think so.
One more quick question before we pack up.
Question for me.
Oh, I wasn't going to, but I will ask you very quickly. Would you rather find a dinosaur egg or make a century at Lord's for England?
I'd rather make a century for England at Lord's.
Okay, that's the right answer. But I was going to ask you Kevin Doherty's question. Of the three executed Tudor-era Thomases, now this is a brilliant preview. We're doing a live show at Hampton Court, aren't we? Hampton Court Palace.
Yeah, what day are we doing that?
It's the 16th of June, I think, Tom. So that's at Hampton Court Palace. If you haven't got your tickets already,
beat the stampede.
Yes, absolutely. It'll be a show about Tudors and executions. So Tom, Kevin says, of the three executed Tudor Thomases, so Thomas More, Thomas Cromwell, and Thomas Cranmer, you have to execute one, imprison one for life, and put one of them back in power. How would you decide? What'd you do?
I'd execute Cromwell. I'd put Cranmer back in power, and so therefore I would imprison More, but I'd let him write.
Right. I'd execute More. I would put Cromwell back in power, and I'd probably imprison Cranmer for life if I had to, but I'd put him back as well. I'd let them crack on.
Yeah, all right.
But I'd definitely execute more.
I think you're definitely sounder on the Reformation than me.
Totally sound, Tom.
Yeah. All right, well, so there's a little taster.
Yeah.
For the fun and games that there will be at Hampton Court Palace.
Great. I mean, Thomas More is ultimately disloyal, Tom.
Not to his God. Not to his God.
No, but to put God above your king and your country is unbelievable. To put your petty prejudices.
He was putting England first.
No, he wasn't.
Of course he was.
He absolutely wasn't.
England was precious to the Virgin.
Oh, come on. Right. This is very poor.
Come on.
We'll have to come back to this. Maybe we'll come back to it in our next bonus episode. Who knows? Anyway, we will leave you in the company of the Habsburgs and of General Custer. And we'll see you for the next bonus episode next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.